Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf. Once again, talking about the game we all love.
Yeah, we're here. It's still bright and sunny outside. It doesn't really feel like snooker season yet, but it's weirdly close, less than a couple of weeks ago before the season gets underway. So we're excited for it, aren't we?
Very much so, Phil. We are. It doesn't feel like very long. It's not very long, let's be clear, since Luca Purcell celebrated that most famous of world titles less than a couple of months. But yes, the beautiful table game is back, and we'll look ahead to the Championship League a bit later. We must just say, first of all, Phil, a big thank you for your response out there to our episode on the match-fixing verdicts following the sport's biggest match-fixing scandal. Probably the saddest episode we've ever recorded, Phil, but clearly a necessary one. And we have to say, you know, your kind words out there about our reflections on what has been a pretty dreadful affair have been very much appreciated, haven't they?
Yeah, definitely. There's been some really good response to that. And it was certainly our most serious episode. Definitely. We had to set the tone appropriately, but hopefully we did that. Pretty grim stuff, but it's got to be covered, isn't it? You know, it's an enormous story for the sport. Grim time for the sport, but, you know, hopefully we can move on now.
Exactly. I know you've got some more reaction, which we'll talk about later as well. And that episode now with nearly 1,500 downloads, more than 2,500 listens on Apple devices. So a genuine thank you for tuning in and for engaging with us on a tough episode to work on, and we're sure for many of you to listen to. Well, this week, Phil, we're focusing a lot more on matters on the table, including a look back to the conclusion of Q School, and later, as we said, a look ahead to the first tournament of the new season, the Championship League. And we're doing so in the company of a very special guest, one of the eight players that made it through this year's Q School. It's someone who has been on a professional tour for the past four seasons. He was named Rookie of the Year following his debut campaign in 2019-20. But last season was much harder work, and he fell out of the top 64, meaning he had to go through Q School to win his tour card back. But then comes that good news line. He did exactly that, beating Ryan Davies at Event 2 to seal his place back on the main circuit for the next 2 years. His emotional reaction after that victory said it all about how much it meant to him, and we are delighted that he's with us on Talking Snooker. Louis Heathcote joins us on the podcast. Louis, it's great to see you. How are you?
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me. I'm all good.
are you to some extent over Q School now? I'm sure it's stuck with you in some ways, but tell us about the time since.
I think I went out on a bender for about 5 days, I think. and then I've been feeling the effects since that. I've been ill all week. I said, I'm going to get it out of the way last weekend, go and have my fun drinking, and then I'm going to spend this week, I'm just going to play some golf, chill out before I start practicing next week. And I've been in bed all week. I've had to cancel all my golf matches and all sorts. So I'm a bit gutted about that, but hopefully I'll be fresh for Monday and I can start back practicing.
Good stuff. Do you know when you're back on the table in the Championship League yet, or has that come out?
No idea yet. It could be next week or in 5 weeks' time. So I've just got to be prepared for whichever one that is.
And I think, I mean, you needed a bit of a blowout after Q School. You could tell by the interview you did with World Snooker how much it meant to you and how draining it was. I mean, it's such a unique experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so weird. It's not like any other pro tournament. It's because if you lose in a pro tournament, you've got another tournament in a few weeks, and this 10 days was dependent for my next year or 2 years on tour. So, or not just on tour, but in my life. So, it's massive. It was like everything. So, I'm glad it's over.
And I mean, I guess you're trying not to think about this, but is it impossible to think about what is coming if you don't get through while you're there?
Yeah. People around me don't let me forget it, put it that way. They ask, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to get a job? And I'm like, well, I've still got a chance to get my tour card back. Let's just cross that bridge when it comes to it. You know what I mean? So I sort of, you know, spoke to the Chinese eight ball people and arranged this sort of thing with them to go over there and play some Chinese eight ball. And they agreed that if I didn't get on tour, I could go as much as I wanted. And if I did get on tour, I can go as and when I'm free. So I did have that as a bit of a backup. But, you know, snooker's been my life since I was 12, 13 years old. And that's what I want to do with my life. So that was my main focus.
You obviously didn't come through event one. So I guess that obviously focuses the mind. But in many ways, it must increase the pressure. Just tell us about your feelings as you go into event two. You know, it's a bit of a last chance saloon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even look at event two until I lost in event one. I was had that sort of strong minded that I was going to do everything it took to get through event one. I didn't even look at event two. So when I lost, I thought, right, I've got to check when I play who I've got and stuff like that. It was a weird one because I felt like I was playing really well and I felt really good in myself. And I think I played on the same table twice and the white was really, really light. And, you know, I'm not one to sort of make excuses. I'll always just blame myself for these mistakes. But I can tell in myself when I'm timing the ball well and stuff like that. So for what I wasn't missing balls. I was losing the white a lot. My scoring was nowhere near as heavy as usual. And my safeties, I was coming back down the table, leaving the white past the boot line. So I sort of knew maybe I wasn't playing the best, but I knew that I wasn't playing that bad. I could tell it myself. So I sort of had to just regroup and tell myself that, you know, you do feel good and you're playing well and you are one of the best players here and you've got to use that to your advantage in the next event.
Mm. I mean, the thing about Q School is everyone's under pressure in every event to an extent, but everyone's under that same kind of intense pressure. So it sort of spreads, doesn't it, I imagine, the atmosphere there. You can almost feel it in the air. And it sounds to an outsider like me that's not been there, that I use that word cloying a few times on here. It just seems like it's all an enveloping type thing.
Yeah, them last 2 days especially, you know, you walk in there and it's quiet. There's not many people talking. The practice room's dull and quiet and stuff. So you can definitely tell it's a different atmosphere to any other tournament.
And I mean, this is a cliche, really, but it is so hard. I mean, Alfie Burden looked like he played really well against you in that game in the first event, and then you come back and the first two games in the second, Paul Deville and Mitchell Mann. You know, that's a very tricky start. You do get the odd player who, you know, you'd be very heavy favourite against, but there's a lot of ways you can trip up there, isn't there?
Yeah, 100%. And you know, after losing, you start, you know, these negative thoughts sort of creep in a bit, and then you think, oh, I've got to play Paul, who's a good player. You know, he's English amateur champion. He's won a few matches as a top up, and you think, crap, this is like, I've got to come here, bring my A game, and you know, and then you get through that, and you play Mitchell Mann. It doesn't get any easier. He's sort of a player that will be there for 20 hours if needs be, so you know you've got to really stick it out to beat someone like him. So yeah, just really proud to make the right decisions at the right times and score heavy when I needed to and pot them balls when it mattered. So it just shows that I can do it under the immense amount of pressure.
Yeah, and I think those two breaks, so your final match against Ryan Davies You know, that must have been a horrible feeling halfway through that match. It must have been hard not to panic a little bit, but then to get over the line with a century and then I think a 70-odd, that shows something, doesn't it? It shows you've got something.
Yeah, it was so weird. Like, when I played Simon Bedford in the round before, I could honestly think that's one of the best I've played for a while. Like, I scored so heavy. Every time he missed, he got punished. I think I had four breaks to win, and I felt really good. And then I played Ryan, and I had a sort of half chance in the first round, but left myself a tricky pink in the middle, and I missed it. And it sort of shocked me, like, to not play as well as I did in the last match. But you have to sort of, you know, it's a different match, but the match just didn't go the way I sort of planned in my head. You know, you just wanted a nice game and a comfortable match, and this game was so scrappy. I think his billiard side really helped him. He put me in his lines are really good and safeties and stuff. He put me in a lot of trouble, and it was just everything was going safe. It wasn't going my way. I was just trying to say, just stick in there. You've not come this far to lose in the last round and be an amateur. So, yeah, the first time I actually got in the balls was at 3-2. Like, the first time I actually got in at the start of the frame and had a good look in was 3-2, and I made 111. And then he sort of played a bad safety shot in the last and stuck me right behind the brown. The balls were absolutely, like, lovely. So I missed that four times, I think, and ended up landing on it. And then he missed the red and I ended up, yeah, making 74, which was probably one of the best breaks of my life. So, yeah.
Do you think, because you're still young, you're 25, do you feel like you've got quite a lot of experience now, really? Did you feel that making a difference in that situation?
Yeah, I think so. I think knowing that I've done it before and knowing that I've beat top players under pressure and, you know, made good breaks when I needed to and against top players. So I think, you know, that's always in the back of your mind saying, yeah, I've done this before. I've played matches to keep my tour hard and he's never done this before. So I said, went to the toilet and come back, said to myself, just try and use your last 4 years, do whatever it takes to come out and be the winner of this match. And, you know, thank God I did.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've all sort of started saying it already there. I just wonder what you were telling yourself at 3-2. You know, just it's such a backs against the wall moment then, isn't it? And as we've already said, to then play such good snooker, that's a real credit to you. I mean, those last two frames weren't horrible, scrappy affairs. They could easily have been with those high stakes, but you make those breaks and that just must give you just so much sort of confidence.
Yeah, 100%. You know, like I said, I went to the toilet and said, listen, you know, use everything you have. You just give every ball everything you have. And if you do lose, then you can just say well done to Ryan. At least you've given it everything. But, you know, I just wanted a fair crack and a chance to try and get it to 3-all. And I got one chance and took it. And, you know, and then you go again and say, right, just give me one more chance. And I got one more chance and took it. So, yeah, hopefully, like, now I've got all this experience and stuff. And, you know, I've had my 4 years and I fell off. And I think it's a testament to, you know, it shows character to go back there and get through and play like that under pressure. So, yeah, hopefully I can really start kicking on now and making some ground.
Yeah, we hope so, obviously. And, you know, we look, when you mentioned your emotional reaction, I mean, that video was, in a way, quite a tough watch. I imagine it was quite a tough interview to do. You could see not just yourself, actually, quite a few players this year and both years, but I think there's a particularly hard sort of set of matches and circumstances this year. And you really showed your emotion there. And it must have been quite a hard interview to do, but it just came over just how much you put into it, how much it meant.
Yeah, it was really tough, man. Like, even before we tried to start the interview, we had to stop a couple of times because I was just crying. You know, it's when you lose your tour card, it's like so such a hard thing to take. Like you practice so hard to be a professional, and you almost take it for granted when you're on tour. Like, you know, I found myself sort of moaning about venues and setups, and you know, having to go in these leisure centres and no one there, and I was moaning about stuff, and I sort of brought negative vibes on myself throughout the season, and I think that showed in my results because I was, you know, being negative about stuff, and then as soon as you lose your tour card, you think, wow, man, like this, you know, like you're so appreciative to actually be a professional snooker player. You take it for granted what you had, and it literally does mean everything to be a professional. So I was really gutted dropping off, and you know, I worked really hard throughout the summer to prepare for Q school, and it was a tough event this year, only two events. So it was out of like 250 people, only 8 people got on. So, and all that stress just built up, and I think a lot of it was just relief just to get through, and you know, how much it means to my family and like my mum. Me and my mum have been through like tough times and tough results and stuff. So it just meant everything to not just me, but everybody around me as well, because it's tough for them as well.
And I'm really interested by you talking about your negative talk there and how you kind of switched that round. I guess some of it was more organic. You kind of had to. But how did you get yourself out of that mind? I mean, how did you get yourself into it in the first place? And how did you get yourself out of it?
I think it was, you know, my first year on tour, I absolutely loved it. You know, I was going to these home nations events. Yeah, fair enough. It was travelling a bit more. So it might cost a bit more to lose in the first round. But even in these qualifiers, if I have to go to Wigan, it's not much difference than going to like Cardiff for the Welsh Open. But then if you win, you have to pay the another expenses to go to the venue. So to go to these events, and you know, you're walking through kids in their swimsuits and families, and you're sitting in your waistcoat, and you're playing in a basketball court with two tables with no one in, it's tough. And I just got myself in a mindset where I was like, is this the incentive to be a professional snooker player? You work all your life and you get to play in the back of a basketball court. So I thought I got wrapped up in it all. You know, you see stuff on Twitter and you see people moaning. You think, yeah, that's right. So you start moaning, and then these negative vibes come off. And I think it really does show in my results that I wasn't in the best mental, I wasn't in the best mindset going into the season or throughout the season. And I just sort of tried, you know, I thought I was aware of that. I deleted Twitter for a bit and tried to get away from it. And, you know, just said to myself, just try and be as positive as you can. That's what the same mindset I went in when I qualified through Q School the first time. So I said, well, it's done it before, you know, just try and be as positive as you can. Just positive vibes everywhere you go. And yeah, hopefully, you know, that'll make a difference.
I guess the pandemic didn't help, because you came on in 2019, and then, you know, by the next year, it's all behind closed doors. And that feeling of, you know, I've worked so hard to become a professional, you're getting to play in tournaments, but it wasn't what you expected, I assume.
No, you bang on. Like the first season, we was like going everywhere. I went to China and in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, was straight to the venues for the home nations. And there was a lot, even at the qualifiers, it was an open crowd. So you go to Barnsley, there'd be, or Sheffield or Barnsley, and there'd be 8 tables, and there'd be crowd in there. So you sort of still feel like you're at a proper event. So to go from that, and that was like, I was living a dream, to then coming back and, you know, playing behind closed doors, and which I did get for the first bit. But then when it opened up, they sort of kept it the same. And, you know, I really struggled with getting myself up for matches when, you know, you like you say, you're in the back of a leisure centre with 2 tables and no one there. It was tough.
Because that first season, 2019, you made a bit of a flying start. I mean, coming through, I was having a look at your results from there, the Q School 2019. So beat Xie Zhaohui to come through. I mean, that's a top win. Now we know how good he is. And won your first 2 games, I think, Ryan Day and Nopon Sankam. So you must have been feeling great coming on tour there.
Yeah, do you know, I did another podcast the other day, and I said that was the best, hands down, the best month of my life. Like, I think it was a funny story, because I lost to CGI in the first event of Q School 4-0, and then I was 3-0 down in the last round to him, and needed a snooker at 3-0, needed a snooker at 3-1.
Wow. And then
made 2 good visits again to win 4-3. And then 2 weeks later, I beat Ryan Day, and then beat Nopon to qualify for China. And then the day after I beat Nopon, flew to Napa for a lad's holiday. So that, like, that stint of time, I was just like living the absolute dream. And I remember doing an interview for World Snooker, and I was in Napa, and I was in the hotel reception. I was absolutely steaming. And I was on the phone trying to act sober as much as I could, trying to questions, and I just think it didn't have a care in the world. I was absolutely leathered.
Amazing. I didn't know that, or if I did know, I'd forgotten that you needed snookers in two of those frames. I mean, what?
Yeah,
that's a proper sliding doors moment, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Still look back and like have the video of when I got on tour and when I need someone videoed it, and when I, you know, need to find a bit of inspiration, I sometimes watch it back, and it every time I watch it, I get goosebumps, and it's still mad that sort of happened to get on tour. It's like you don't really see that very often. So, but I do look. If I didn't get on tour, like if I didn't do that, then where would I be now? Like, what would you reckon? I'd be a pro, or would I have just be working? It's just crazy that you just don't know what would have happened if I didn't do that. So,
I was looking at those results. That Ryan Day win was in the Riga Masters, and then I thought, well, how come there was a walkover? And it was that. So you didn't play in the next one because you were on that plane that got cancelled or something. That was right, is it?
Yeah. The first time I ever travelled away for a pro snooker tournament was sat on the plane ready to fly and never took off. I felt like crap. I was gutted.
Which one was that then? Remind me.
That was the Riga Masters.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, goodness, yeah.
And Neil Robertson was on there. I thought, if Neil Robertson's on it, we're definitely going to make it. Like, he doesn't even... he's like number one in the world. We're definitely going to be all right. And then, time went on.
You must be joking. He's the biggest Jonah out there. He can't even get to events in the UK, let alone.
I know, yeah.
Well, you certainly already filled in nicely the sort of ups and downs of the sort of snooker life. And it's not always, we said this time and time again on Fear Phil. Obviously, we're the other side of the curtain for the media, but it's not all glamour for you guys, is it, Louis?
No, it's far from it, you know, I brought one of my friends to qualify, is right, and we was playing at up near Birmingham somewhere, I can't remember where it is, but anyway, it was to get through to the tournament, you had to walk through a golf shop, like a golf pro shop, and it was like I think it's like a council golf course, and to get through to the tournament, you have to like walk through it, and I was sat in this like tiny little thing, and there was like two tables and no one there. And he goes, "I cannot believe that this is the tournament you play." And he's like, he just thought that was playing in these big arenas all the time. And I was like, "Nope, get used to it, mate. We've got Barnsley where there's a Wet and Wild. There's a golf shop. And then we've got Wigan's Leisure Centre. We've got a basketball cast. So it's like, I said, it's not all glitz and glamour, mate. We're stuck in the trenches back here.
Is that Cannock, that one you're talking about?
Yeah, Cannock.
Yeah, I've not been, but I've not heard great things in general.
No, it's not great.
Well, the Barnsley Metrodome, I said it before, I didn't once enter the press room without being asked if I wanted a towel. Now, you know... I mean, I'm a nobody, obviously, but you're not a nobody. You're a professional snooker player, Louis. And I mean, we mock. There are some wonderful venues on the circuit, obviously, but for a lot of those qualifiers, a lot of those quotes unquote smaller events, you know, it's rough and ready. You have to get used to the kind of the other side of life, eh?
Yeah. Well, you feel like a hot donut, mate, walking through with your queue and waistcoat when there's 100 kids in their swimsuits and that queuing up for the slides. You feel like a flipping donut, but it is what it is, you know. Like I said, I was very negative towards it last year, and I think that showed in my results. So I'm trying to go in this season with a new mindset and just, you know, I can't change it. So I'm going to try and be as positive as I can.
Well, I was going to ask actually specifically at Q School, but in general, in these sort of environments, is it helpful to have someone with you? I know you've got Steve Feeney working with you now. It must be helpful to have someone... Well, helping in a range of ways, but taking your mind off that kind of thing.
Oh, I think not too many people, but obviously working with Steve has been great. But if I just have a friend there, I don't care where I am. You sort of just have a laugh with your mate and you're not bothered. You can find anything to do and anything to talk about. So you sort of forget what's gone on. But, you know, it's when you're traveling on your own and you're sat there in these places, it can be tough. But, you know, everyone has to do it. And, you know, who am I to sort of say, we shouldn't be playing here and whatnot. So it's just something I've got to deal with and try and, you know, find a way to make me feel like I'm playing in front of a crowd inside when I'm not. So it's my problem. It's one of them things.
Mm-hmm. And working with Steve, how did that come about, and how much did it change your sort of? I mean, it's all the sighting alignment and stuff. Was that a big change to your game?
Yeah, half of it I found like easy, and then there's other times where I was going back to my old ways. And it came about originally because, you know, my results wasn't the best anyway, and I sort of found myself missing so many balls at a certain time, the same certain time in a match. It was either like under a bit of pressure or a mid-range red or even an easy red, and it was a big part of a frame or a big part of a match, and I'd always sort of missed them, and I thought there's got to be a reason why. I can pop balls like off the lampshade, you know, but when it comes to that sort of certain time in the match, I was missing them. And obviously, you know, I'm really good friends with Ollie and stuff, and he was working with him, and he sort of suggested it. So I spoke to him, and we had a few sessions, and it was mainly for me to have something to fall on under pressure, something to rely on, and have a pre-shot routine, because you know now you have to like line up and stuff, and that gives me a pre-shot routine before I get onto this shot. And before, I was sort of just getting down on the shot and from any angle and playing them any sort of way. So this sort of gives me a pre-shot routine and something to rely on under pressure, and also someone to be there for you as well, which is good. Someone knows what he's talking about. So I know my results haven't improved, but I think I've improved as a player, but my results have not come with it. So I'm just trusting the process, and hopefully they'll come.
Mm-hmm. Well, Phil mentioned a few moments there again of Q School. Reminds me that we maybe should dot the I's and cross the T's a little bit more from event two there, actually, and say that the players to make it through were Alfie Burden, Stuart Carrington, our special guest today, Louis Heathcote, and Dean Young. Louis, as we've already said, beat Ryan Davies 4-3 from 3-2 down. Those two breaks you mentioned from you, Louis, of 111 and 74. Well, we should say Burden was 3-2 behind in his pivotal match against Julian Boyko, but came back to win 4-3. And he said afterwards, there were so many emotions. I actually tried to pull out of Q School after the World Seniors. He lost to Jimmy White, if you remember, in the final of that. And Burden says, well, I thought I let my family down by not winning that event. I felt very down and didn't want to pick my cue up. But I had a few days practice, came here and rolled the dice. Q School is so tough. After I won, I went to the toilet and there was a kid bent over the sink crying his eyes out because he had lost. It was Florian Nussler, and I feel for him. We'll come maybe in a moment to say quite why he was suffering so much. I almost wanted to swap places with him because I have had a long career while he's just a young kid starting out and wanting it so badly, trying to win a place on the tour. Everything I do is for my children, and I'm just delighted to win today. And they're sad things to see, Louis. Have you seen anything quite like that and scenes of players being quite that distraught at that event?
No. You know, I seen Florian sat at the table. I went up to him, just put my arm around and said, just keep playing. You're such a good player, and, you know, just stick at it. It's sad to see because it really does mean so much to everyone, you know. Like I said, we're playing to get our jobs back, but they're playing to live their dream and then fulfil their dream of becoming a professional. And, you know, they're not going to have another chance now for a year or so. So it's tough for everyone. And even Alfie, like, you know, he's older, he's had a long career, and he got emotional in his interview. And it just shows how much it still means to people like that who have had a long career and they're still getting back on now.
How much can you be aware of what's going on at Q School? Are you just so sort of wrapped up in what you're doing? Can you see who's getting through on the other tables, or do you not really know?
Oh, you can see. I was 3-2 down, and I seen AB had just got on, and they were just packing away and stuff. And I looked over, and we sort of just caught eyes, and he started like giving a fist bump to me and that. And I was thinking, yeah, I'm happy for you, mate, but I'm 3-2 down here. I'm bang under pressure. I think the yard here, mate. Like, you kind of a bit in or something. That. Me and AB get along really well, and he's such a great man. He's always been there for me. You know, I remember we was at at the World when I played Ali Carter, when I beat Ali Carter, he was playing his last match. I think he was going to drop off if he didn't beat Wembo, I think. And I was 4-0 up at the interval and he had his at the same time. And I think he was 3-1 down. He spent the whole 15 minutes talking to me and trying to help me for my game rather than his own. And I just thought that's sort of just a testament to sort of the person he is. But he's fighting for his tour card to fall off for the first time and he's spending his last 15-minute interval trying to help me with my game. So, yeah, he's just a good lad and I'm really happy to see him back on tour.
Well, that does sound.
You get on with a lot of players on tour. I'm sure we'll go back to what we're talking about then, but that's made me think. You've got a lot of pals on the tour, haven't you? I don't need to name them all, but a few friends that you really get on with in the snooker world.
Yeah, I'm quite a chilled guy, laid back, and you know, if we're going to spend a lot of time together, I want to get along with everyone, and you know, there's people that you get along more than others, but I'd like to think that I could sit and have a conversation with pretty much anyone on the tour, and you know, they're your work colleagues sort of, and you know, you're playing against them on the table, but whilst you're away and you're going to be on your own, you know, you have to. It's good to just have conversations and be chilled and get along. So, you know, I try to get along with everyone in life anyway. So, yeah, I'd like to think I'm pretty approachable and can sit there and chat to anyone.
Yeah, I've heard Ali Carter actually mentioned him there. He's spoken very highly of you before. And that must have been such a huge win. That was in the World Championship qualifiers. I remember that being a very big occasion at the time.
Yeah, it was. I think that was like my first sort of, I'd sort of won a lot of matches that season, but there were first round, second round, people who, you know, like Ryan Day and Knockon, they were fantastic results. But, you know, sort of mid-ranked players, I was sort of just had no fear and I was beating them. And then I'd get to the second or third round and lose to a bigger name. And it comes to that, and that was my sort of, that was where I sort of, you know, had my first sort of really big win against someone. So, yeah, I think Twitter and everything was going off after that, so... It was good, yeah, it was good. It was something I remember forever because I really wanted to win Rookie of the Year that year as well because obviously you only get one chance at it and stuff. So it meant a lot to me to win that trophy and that was probably the reason why I did it, beating Ali. So, yeah.
Well, that's smashing, yeah. We mentioned at the top that was quite a really big deal and a special award for you to pick up. Well, it was a bit difficult for Carrington in a way at Q School because he had a long old wait for his final match. Roy McLeod and Robin Hull battled it out in an epic encounter. I can see you laughing there, Phil. I mean, it was 4 hours, 13 minutes for a best of seven. I mean, good heavens. I mean, no call to give it. Go on, Phil. You're laughing so much. I want to hear you interject.
Well, no, I just remember, I mean, there was a chance that some of the final round games were going to get finished before that semi-final, as it were. Yeah, it was an epic, wasn't it? I mean, you could have, if there was two players who were going to do that, you know, they would have been up there near the top of that list of likely candidates. But that is long, isn't it? That is very long.
It really is. But then, well, in the end, Carrington brushed aside that weight. He beat McLeod 4-0 and then said, "I was expecting to be there all night. I thought it would be a tough match. I was solid. My safety was good, although 4-0 was a bit flattering. The last 18 months have been really difficult for me. It's been mental torture. I've been struggling to pull the cue back. I wasn't expecting a great deal this week, but I've hung in there and fought my way through without hitting the ball well. I have 2 years now to work on that and find the right person who can help me technically as well as mentally." I'm just wondering, Louis, have you ever had that? I'm sure you have had that scenario, but one that really comes to mind where you've had a long wait for a match before, and how do you kind of keep your focus?
The worst one was when we was in COVID. I was actually playing C2I again and we was meant to play at 2 o'clock, but the results didn't come back for the COVID test. I think I actually went on at like 12:15. So we was sat there like waiting around all day waiting for the results. I think it's something that you sort of, for me, I was used to anyway. You know, you go to the amateur tours and you play your group matches and there's always one group that's behind. So you're waiting 3-4 hours to play your last 16 and stuff. So it's nothing that I'd not done before. That was a bit extreme though. But yeah, like you say, you couldn't have picked two people to have a match like that, could you, before for that. And Like we were, I was saying, you know, I was quite jealous of Stu having to come through it. Like he sort of had it pretty easy for him. He said it weren't pretty, but it seemed pretty well enough. That's what you want in the last round. So yeah, fair play to him. You know, I hope he does sort of get his action sorted. He's a nice bloke, and his cue action's like one of the silkiest on tour. He used to time the ball so nice. So I'm not sure what's happened, but I really hope he can get back to his best.
Yeah, he's one of those players that whenever I see him, I think he should be doing better because he looks great, but he doesn't really get loads of results. But yeah, I didn't realise he'd been struggling with sort of a version of the yips, which I don't know if you've ever experienced anything like that, but it must be so horrible. It sounds awful for professionals.
No, I've not, luckily enough, touched wood. But I don't really think about much of my shot. So I don't think, no, hopefully, like, I don't think something like that could really get me. You know, I just feel like I just get down and play the shot. So I don't know if I sort of, I don't know, I think it's easy to say, but I don't know if I, like, believe in something like that, because obviously it's, I've never had it anyway. But I could tell that he was struggling with something in his cue action. His cue came back really quick, and I think he was just trying to, you know, just get it back and go forward. So you can tell that he is struggling. But, you know, he was still knocking in tons of that. I was watching him and he was knocking in tons and knocking in long balls. So he's doing something right. So hopefully he can work on it through the summer and come back and, you know, find a way to time it nice.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, I mean, you've just come through Goose School, the second time you've done it. But there's been seemingly as much as ever talk about whether the setup at Q School is the right thing to do. Could there be changes to it? Are there different systems? Obviously, you're fine with it doing very well there. But do you think it is the right way of sort of getting the best amateur players onto the tour?
Probably not, but I don't know what the answer is. So it's tough. Like, I was thinking about this last night. I thought maybe if they did, they could do three events. One event just for the pros that have come off, four people go on. One event for a mixture of amateurs and pros that have come off. And then one event just for amateurs. And I think that way you'd probably get four fresh new pieces. Maybe a mixture in event. And then it gives a chance for first two pros to battle it out for four spots. I don't really know if that's a good idea or not. I don't know what the answer is, but two events to determine the year is just so tough. I'm obviously lucky I got on and stuff like that, but you know, you have to feel for like so many top players that are not going to be a pro, but just because of how tough it is to sort of get back on. And someone has to get on, and then, and there's going to be loads of people that doesn't. It's just one of them things that that's the way it works.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of vibe I've felt in all the discussions. I've heard a lot of people sort of complaining, but no one's got like a concrete idea of like what the better system is. I think people do like, you know, the Q Tour is improving, I think, and maybe more places off that might be another thing to look down. But, you know, it's hard. There's no answer that everyone's going to be happy with, is there?
And I think, like, we were saying about the Q Tour, like, it's tough for amateurs to fund travelling around Europe for $2,000. That's to the winner. Mm-hmm. So you probably don't win it to make any money. And then only one person gets the tour spot out of... So you've got to travel around Europe all year for the winner to get a tour. I know they have the playoffs as well, but that's you could see it for sort of what I'm saying is to actually get your tour card back. You've got to travel 6-7 times around Europe to potentially get for one space. I think that's brutal as well.
Yeah, it is.
Really is very much so. Carry on, Louis. Sorry.
Just saying you need someone who's going to chuck a load of money into you to give you the chance to do that. But snooker's a weird game for someone to try and get sponsorships, especially at the amateur level. You need someone who's just nice enough just to have a bit of dough and wants to help someone out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it strikes me that, you know, maybe across all sport, but focusing on this sport that we talk about, obviously loads on here, Phil, There's a lot of issues that we sometimes think, oh, this could be better, but it's finding those alternatives, isn't it? That's kind of often the stumbling block. And maybe this is another one as well. It certainly cleans Q School. You have to say that it's brutal, but there's a sort of cleanness to it, definitely. Well, we should just say about Dean Young, he beat the aforementioned Nusler 4-3, and Nusler was 3-1 up actually before Young came back for a 4-3 win. And then this continuing theme of how brutal it is, really, and how tough it is. Young says, I could hardly stand up towards the end. I don't have a clue how I won. He missed a pink at 3-2. He should have closed it out. I had no plan B, so to get through Q School was all or nothing for me. The pressure here is immense. I have never felt anything like that in my life. My first 2 years on tour was an apprenticeship, and I'm hoping to do better next time. That's what I mean, I know you've been on 4 years now, Lou, but that's kind of what you hear from players that are early in their tour life. I like that use of the word apprenticeship there. You're learning your sort of trade, not your trade, you've already learned that, but you're learning what it's like in the sort of hard school of life on tour. And unless you're, you know, a superhuman player like a Hendry or going back or whatever, you need that time, don't you?
Yeah, 100%. I said the exact same after 2 years and I fell off, so hopefully it doesn't follow my suit. But yeah, it literally is like, you know, when I first turned pro, I was just so grateful to be a professional. And the first season, I was just happy to be there and whatever and just use the experience. And then I did well and it got to the second year. You don't want to drop off now. I love doing this. So I think, but it's all part of life lessons, you know. You see, like, Kyron, he's dropped off a few times and Neil Robertson dropped off and things like this just make you stronger, you know, I think. And I think now that it's easy to say this now, but now I've got back on, I'm sort of glad that I dropped off and I've had this heartache and these tough times. I think, like I said, it makes you stronger. And I've practiced a lot through summer. Normally I would have had a break and probably would have only started playing now. So, you know, I feel like I'm going to be sharp and same for Dean Young. He's a good lad and a good player. So, you know, he's got that 2 years behind him, like I said, and he's going to know what to expect now going into.
Well, we feel like if you're breaking up a little bit, Louis, which I think you are from time to time, then it's a few gremlins in the system. So apologies for that. But we should say, not to worry, you are listening here to Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf and our special guest, Louis Heathcote. And, well, Louis, maybe go back to your sort of time on tour so far. Interested to read an interview you did with Phil, actually, when you were talking at the time about how tough it was financially and how you had to make ends meet in other ways, doing other little jobs on the side. We hear that a lot from players. That just adds an extra layer of stress, doesn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, there's never a time that you think about the money whilst you're playing. But it's in the back of your mind, like even, you know, before the tournament, you're thinking about the $3,000 or whatever. Or if you lose, like, I know obviously now we've got the $20,000 guarantee, but in previous times, if you travelled and lost, you'd actually be losing money, and that's not a job, is it? You literally just go to a tournament and you'd be £300-400 down. You could potentially lose 4-3 on the black, and you come out down. And I wouldn't class that as a job. And we're in the top 128 in the world out of 8 billion people. That's an elite category to be in, and I feel like people think, you know, you're millionaires, but you're not half of us a skin.
And yeah, I mean, that you mentioned before about, you know, loving the professional game when you got on there, and you know, the logistics of it must test the love of the game, I guess, at times.
Yeah, there's been times where, like, I've come home and, you know, said, you know, I've been upset or whatever, my mum's been upset, and we say, is it really worth, like, this much hurt? Because you dedicate your life to practicing and then you travel 4 hours up the road, lose 4-3, and you've got to travel back and you're down £300, and you come home and you think, is it really worth all this, like, aggro and stuff? But then you do win, and that feeling outweighs every loss that you have. And playing in front of the venues is the best feeling in the world. So, But yeah, there is times where you think it would be easier just to get a job, and you'd probably get, I don't know, minimum $2,000 a month that keeps you going or whatever. And, you know, at least you know you're guaranteed that at the end of every month.
But those highs keep you coming back. And I suppose Q School seems like it's more of a relief, but that must have been a great high in a way, though, as well.
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah. Like you say, like, Q School's a relief, but it means more than, like, probably anything, because, you like you say, it is all or nothing, and you're playing for the job. Now you've got to go and do the business, but at least I've given myself a chance. So, yeah, I think there's no feeling like Q School, getting through Q School. I'd say the best day of my life was my first, when I turned pro for the first time. And then, like, you could see how much it meant to me qualifying it again. I've never been like that after a tournament on the pro circuit.
Mm-hmm. Louis, it strikes me you talk about your family quite a lot. I mean, you seem like you have some immensely close relationships with them, your family members, and it seems like they've been a great support to you over the years.
Oh, big time. You know, without them, I wouldn't have a chance to even, you know, be here. Like, my dad was working 6 a.m. till 6 at night, travelling around, and then he'd take me to Leeds on a Friday night tournament and stuff. So, you know, without him doing that every single week, I wouldn't be here now. And, you know, it's just me and my mum living here, and she sees me, like, obviously me and my mum are, like, really close, and she sees all the down times and the hard days, and she loses with me, so it really affects her as much as me. And I think she wants me to win more than I do. She's that, like, passionate for me and proud of me and stuff. And, you know, she just wants me to be happy. And, you know, when she sees me upset because it's tough, you know, it's not nice for her. So you have to, you know, because there's so many more lows than highs, so you have to really appreciate the highs when you get them.
And it sounds like, in many ways, the emotion was as much for them as yourself when you had that sort of Q School moment. And I think we can all reflect on that in our own lives. Sometimes you just realise how much people mean to you, what they've done. And it does bring those emotions right to the surface, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it just shows that how much, like, they care for you as well. Like, all my friends were sort of crying, watching my interview and stuff. And it just shows you, like, the people that you have around you and how much they care about you as well. These are, like, my mates watching my interview and they're tearing up and stuff. And, you know, like, my girlfriend, you know, we're trying to save her house and stuff. And she's like, should we do this? Should we do that? And I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm going to have a job in 2 weeks. And you want to book an holiday and stuff. I'm like, you know, because she's got a job and she wants to do stuff. And she's like, oh, should we go here? Or, you know, we're trying to save for a house. And I'm like, my head's just like, I don't know what if I'm going to be stacking shelves in Tesco or playing snooker or anything like that. So, you know, it is tough for everyone, especially like her. You know, she, you know, we are trying to, you know, we want to get a house and start a family, but snooker's a weird sort of weird job to do that, because you don't know if you're going to get paid 3 months or you're going to get paid $50,000 in 1 week. So,
yeah, absolutely. Bill, we've got some correspondence in, haven't we? We're pleased to say. Maybe we'll turn to that now. You get a compliment in the first one, which I'm sort of half pleased about when that happens. You know that.
Yeah, that was very kind of. This is from Mikey on Twitter. Love the podcast and would like to let you know what a superb job you're doing. Thanks very much, Mikey. I was an occasional listener until I met Phil a couple of seasons ago at Judgment Day. He was a delight to me. There's the compliment. Lovely. Since then, I haven't missed a second of what you two have recorded. Love it. I'd like to congratulate Louis on his graduation from Q School. Everyone agrees how tough it is, even for seasoned pros like himself. Now it's about surviving and then climbing up those rankings. Louis strikes me as a hard worker, but I'm wondering if there's anything he'd do differently this time around in terms of snooker life behind the scenes.
Yeah, good question. 100%, you know. I'm a hard worker, but I do let myself down as well. You know, I'm not the healthiest. I go out drinking a bit too much. You know, I do enjoy going out a lot. That sort of hard work I do putting in the week, sometimes I do ruin on the weekend and stuff. So, you know, going into this season, I plan to be a lot healthier, get back into the gym and try and have a clear mind and try and do a lot more things that are going to benefit me on a weekend rather than going out on the lash watching the football and stuff. I think it's good now and again you need a break, but you know, every Saturday is not the best.
Yeah, of course. Well, let's move on then to Gary, who asks, you said, hello, Louis, who were your snooker heroes growing up?
Ronnie, for me. Ronnie was my hero growing up. He was the one that sort of made me get into snooker. I'd watch his videos like for hours on end. I'd just type Ronnie O'Sullivan and watch his best breaks and pots. And then I'd go and try and reciprocate that in practice the next day. So yeah, I was starstruck by Ronnie growing up.
And I remember when he said something very nice about you, he sort of tipped you to go a long way, and that must have meant a huge amount coming from him then.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. I remember waking up in the morning, someone tagged me in a tweet and someone said, oh, this is nice of Ronnie or something. And I thought, what the frick is this guy on about? And it took me to the thing what he said, and I was just like smiling like a Cheshire cat all day. I was like screen recording it, sending it to all my mates in group chats and my mum. You know, I was buzzing. I was absolutely buzzing. But I was like, I played it cool, like when people asked me in interviews and that. But deep down, I was so gassed.
This next one's from M18 Snooker on Twitter. Is there any added pressure being from a snooker hotbed like Leicester?
It's a weird one, that, because I don't know if it's added pressure, but I can't walk in the club without talking about snooker 20 times.
Mm.
Like, I'll go in there for a drink or just to chill, and I'll have the same I have a group of people come up to me asking me the same question. So I'd sort of start at the door, make myself way down to the bar, and I'd go for about 20 people. So it's a weird one. Like, they're always asking me how I'm getting on and stuff. So maybe without knowing there is, but I don't really think about it at the time. But then I go in the club and I can't sort of avoid it. So
yeah, that's interesting, actually. Yeah, it might not be the... You obviously got a lot of practice partners around there and good conditions and stuff, but yeah, that's quite an intense working environment then, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like, for me, obviously, when I practice, the club's not open till 4, so I go in and get my practice done. But I do spend a lot of time in the club and that. So, and especially when tournaments are in Leicester, like, even go through Q School and that, my club's so busy, so I'd go in and chill for a bit before heading over, and you'd have 15, 20 people come up to you and talk about your game. Partly my fault for going in before a match, but they're only trying to be nice and stuff. But then you also, you know, that they're all asking you about it, and it does bring that sort of edge on going over to the game. So yeah, it's a weird one, but like you say, they're only trying to show support and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You talked about Ronnie being a hero. I wonder what your sort of feelings are towards Mark Selby and how much of a great champion he's been, and you know what I mean, you know. Just a great Leicester man and sports person.
Yeah, he's such a great ambassador for the game. He's a true professional. And I think if anyone growing up should try and have his attitude to the game. When I was younger, I used to say, like, oh, you know, he's slow and boring and stuff. And when I was a kid, and because everyone around Leicester used to love Mark, and I was a Ronnie fan. So I'm like, oh, Ronnie's better in here, blah, blah, blah. And it weren't till I got a little bit older that I actually learned to appreciate how good he actually is. And, you know, I could actually sit there and watch him play it all day. He's so good at what he does and the way he thinks, and he scores so heavy and stuff. So he's actually really good to watch, and he's actually one of the nicest blokes you'll meet as well. He was the first person to message me when I got on tour again, and played golf with him a few times and stuff last year. And yeah, he's a great, great man. So yeah, he's good to have someone like that. He's probably the best sports person from Leicester, I'd say, and he will go down in history for being one of the greatest ever, I think.
I wonder what started making you appreciate him more. Was it just yourself learning more about snooker, maybe you changing a bit as you were growing up? I'm interested by that.
Yeah, I think it was me, like me growing as a person and growing as a player. Because you are young and you just say stuff stupidly and or whatever without even thinking. So when I actually learning the game a bit more and I got a bit better, when I was 15 or so, started to think, oh, this guy is actually like amazing at the game, and his true grit and mentality is something that I need to strive for and learn from. So it was more when I sort of grew as a person and a player that I learned to appreciate how good he actually is. And, you know, I'd go out my way to watch him play now, and I could watch him play all day.
Mm. Oh, that's great to hear. And let's move on then to John on Twitter, who asks, what made you play that shot? And I think you probably know which shot he means. When snookered on the yellow against Ryan Day. And how often do you watch it now?
I watch it every time it comes up. Not often, but when it does, I'll always milk it. To be honest, it was one of them where it was the only shot I had. Like, I was so tight in behind the black. There's nothing I could have done. So it's just something that, you know, it was... I play to hit it and play to get near it. And I was more thinking, if I miss it, I hope he just don't clear up, because I knew the brown was safe. So I was half hoping I left it on and he tried to clear up. But because there was no one in there, you don't realise how sort of crazy it is. I just sort of apologised to him and he was absolutely fuming. I could just see his face, he was acid, but I was inside thinking, flipping up. But because there's no one in there, you don't realise the reaction. And I sort of ended up losing the match anyway. So come off. And then Twitter was just mental. It was all over Sky Sports. It was the Telegraph Times. It was that on telly, and Gary Lineker retweeted it. And it was mental. Absolutely mental.
Did you say acid there?
Yeah.
Bill, that's a keeper. When I see someone in a right old mood, that's an acid face. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, that properly went. That was a proper viral moment. I was up there with sort of that shot Judd played in the German Masters. It went just one of those, just goes absolutely everywhere.
Yeah. Bit different to Judd. Mine was a fluke and he just cued it in dream. But he, I'll take it nevertheless.
Now looking ahead to the future, excited to be back on, obviously. You said you're feeling sharp ahead of the new season. Have you set yourself any goals or anything, or is it one of those where you just want to enjoy it more, like you said?
A bit of both. Like, I do want to enjoy it, and, you know, I've learned from my mistakes, being negative, like I said before, and this season I'm going to try going with a new mindset and be a bit more positive, you know, not get the ump over things that I can't control. I'm going to set some goals. I'd love to get to a semi-final or something like that. You know, that's something I really need to improve on is, you know, I win enough first-round matches, but I never kick on from there. I'll always lose in the last 32, last 64. I've only ever been to one last 16 in 4 years, so that's not good enough. So, yeah, I'd love to go a bit deeper in tournaments. I'd love to get to a quarters and a semi-final. I'm really going to try and work hard off the table, more importantly. You know, I work really hard on the table, but I've let myself down off the table. So I'm going to try and make some big changes going into the new season and hopefully really just enjoy it, like you say, and get back to playing some good snooker, yeah.
And maybe get to the Crucible one day?
That would be a dream, yeah. I went up and went during the Worlds and sat outside the Crucible with Aaron Hill. And it just like gives you shivers just thinking about it. And it's one of the only tournaments that I'll make sure I try and sit and watch it, like every shot. Just I love watching the players come out, and I could just sit there and it just, my hair stand up on the back of my neck, and I would love nothing more than to walk out in that that stage one. Hopefully this year, maybe no, next year, if not the year after.
Have you been in to watch a game there before?
I went to watch Ronnie versus Matthew Stevens in, I think it was 2012, semi-final.
No way.
Yeah, that was a big thing for me as well when I went there. I was just so, like, it was a weird feeling. Like, I was in awe of Ronnie. Like, he just had this weird presence about him. And when I left there, I thought, yeah, this is my dream. This is what I'm going to do forever. I've been a few times. I went to a few first rounds and actually went to the last time Alex Higgins ever played, you know, when he played at the Legends thing.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I've been a few times, but I've never been in the back bit or anything like that. So I'm waiting for that when I play.
Yeah.
Well, that bit's rubbish, so don't worry about it. I'm only joking. Well, Louis, what can we say apart from thank you so much? You've been an absolutely brilliant guest today. You've been so funny, so illuminating. We wish you so well for the new season and, of course, your future. And will you come back and see us one day, even if you're world champion?
First of all, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. I'll be on here any time. And of course, I come on here, especially when I'm world champion. Anytime you ever want anything, any interviews, any time on the podcast, I'll always have time for you both.
Very kind of you, Louis, and always a pleasure to speak to. I can say that from personal experience. Always a treat to interview. So yeah, I'll echo what Nick said. Best of luck for the season. We all want to see you do well.
Thank you, and you both keep up the good work, eh?
That's all, mate. Appreciate it.
Cheerio, sir. All the best to you. That's Louis Heath there. What a terrific guest. Fabulous. Our first guest of this summer season, Phil. And we couldn't have wished for a much of a better one there. He was absolutely smashing value, wasn't he? So funny about that. Sounds a bit sort of listening to your own pod, but I actually really enjoy listening back there to some of his sort of jokes about tournament venues and, you know, being in his waistcoat and walking through sort of swimming areas. Great stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I mentioned, you sort of hear his name mentioned by a lot of other pros of just sort of people they like on the tour. And when you get to speak to him, you see why. Just a lovely, genuine guy. So, yeah, everyone wants to see him do well. And he's legitimately a very, very good player. So it's certainly not out of the question that he'll pull off those things that he was talking about, getting to quarters, getting to semis. He's definitely good enough. So, and it would be a very popular result if it did come.
It certainly would. Now, Phil, we should say this is a talking snooker here, and we'll move on to other matters before we depart. The Championship League, Phil, will kick off the 23-24 season. And as we know, there are now more episodes of the Championship League in an average year than there are EastEnders.
Absolutely. Yeah, there it is.
You gave me a nice little. I thought you might give one of those sort of, oh, Mark, what's he doing again? Face. It's not a good gag. It really isn't. But there we go. Bill, it's a low key start, as we know. It's a pretty meandering kind of tournament, isn't it? The Championship League. I was looking. It's starting next Monday in Leicester, and lasting until July 21st. I was having a look at some of the sort of events that we'll enjoy, sort of during it. So we're going to have basically the majority of the Ashes series, which is just getting underway here in the UK, the whole of the tennis grass court season, including Wimbledon, heaven knows how many Grand Prix, one of them being Silverstone, and then we'll finally see a winner crowned during the Open Championship in the late part of July. What I'm saying is it's a proper slow burner, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And there's not loads we can say about it yet because the draw hasn't happened. We know when it starts, but we don't know what the groups are or anything, so I'm sure that'll be coming in the very near future. It's a low-key start, but it's an enjoyable one just to flick on every so often, have simmering away in the background. And actually, I've heard a few players say that it's actually quite a nice sort of low-pressure start to the season. You're not going in after your summer break playing for big money or with a huge title on the line. But we also know that it's a great title to win come the business end at the end of July. You know, we had Dave Gilbert on here after he'd won it, and it meant an awful lot. So, yeah, it's I think I always use this line, it's no one's favourite tournament. Which sounds mean, but it's true. It is literally no one's favourite tournament, but it's still worth a watch.
We should ask someone. So, you know, big statement there. Is it someone's favourite tournament? Let us know.
I'd be stunned. I would love to know the reasoning behind it if it is anyone's favourite tournament. And we'll either lie, if it is yours.
We'll need a lie detector test as well, because I'm sure a cheeky rascal or two might just tell us it is. We'll need some evidence, really, good evidence. Well, the winners of the ranking event version, Kyron Wilson, obviously a serial winner of big tournaments, Dave Gilbert, who you mentioned. And important to say, Dave's first and still only ranking event. It might always be his only ranking event, but he'll take that. It means forever and a day, he's not one of those players that didn't make it to win one. He did so. So, you know, it has that status, it should be said. And then, of course, last year, Luca Purcell, a proper old sandwich, that wasn't it, Phil? It appeals to my mind, certainly, that he won the first event and the last, of course, that most famous of wins at the Crucible. But it's sort of much forgotten, really, that he did actually record another tournament win last season at the Championship League.
Yeah, big old gap between the two and very contrasting events. But yeah, you've sort of seen, I mean, this World Championship win was obviously out of the blue, but that was his second ranking title of the season. So, amazing stuff. And that seems an awful long time ago when I remember seeing him hugging his dad, winning the Championship League. A very different setting to celebrating at the Crucible. But yeah, two ranking tournaments, though. It'll go down on the list as just two ranking tournaments, even though they couldn't be more different.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, you know, I know many of you out there will enjoy the fact that snooker's back. I mean, I have to say, I was just thinking this the last couple of days, of the four seasons, I absolutely love autumn snooker. For me, that really kicks off the season proper. Love winter snooker. That's the sort of, in many ways, the soul of the game. Those sort of dark, cold nights here in the UK, wrapped up at home and watching the game. And then, of course, spring, culminating in that wonderful tournament of the Crucible, the World Championship. Summer is one that I find a bit harder. It's a bit more low-key, but it's nice to know it's ticking around. We have a pretty big tournament coming, of course, in Germany in August, but it's sort of nice to know it's back. And it always sort of strikes me. I mean, well, we've had Louis on, of course. He's, you know, saying about how he's practiced more than usual, but you can always sort of tell pretty quickly which ones have been really nailing down the practice time, Phil, and which ones have maybe been... Shall I say, before we came on air, we were chatting to Louis, and you asked him, has he done a Grealish? You turned it into a verb already. We'll find out soon which players have been doing a Grealish this summer.
Well, Louis had a good reason to do a Grealish. He was celebrating something. I don't know how people were just Grealishing without anything specific to celebrate. Sometimes some of those early matches in the Championship League are a little bit ropey. I remember... Yeah, last year, an awful lot of Chinese players were doing very well early on. And they'd obviously been working hard away in the academies over the summer. We'll see. Those early rounds are quite funny. But then, yeah, as I say, when it gets to sort of the latter stage, that final two group stages, when we get to that bit, it does get quite, important. There's a lot of money on the line and a trophy. So, yeah, the long build to July 21st. Begins on June 26th.
Indeed. Well, any other business, Phil? Should say, you've spoken to Ollie Lyons, haven't you? A piece you can see on the Metro website. He's talked of his sadness at being involved in a match at the Yanbing Tao Fixed when Lyons won 5-4 to reach the quarterfinals of a ranking event for the first time at last year's Turkish Masters. One of the things that really comes through, Phil, from your piece is that Ollie can't believe it in many ways, as Yan, at times, as we said as well on here, played so well in that match.
Yeah, I spoke to Ollie earlier in the week because it was two matches because there's that one. And yeah, Yan played brilliantly. I mean, in a way, it's not surprising. He was just like very convincing at match fixing because Ollie's memory of that match was that neither of them missed a ball. Like, he had to play really, really well to beat him. He said if his friend was there and he said it was, you know, that's match of the tournament sort of contender. So to then find out that it was fixed is just mind-boggling, isn't it? But I think the anger in that piece was more that he was also involved in a match that proved to be fixed from 2014, which he has no memory of that match, really. obviously Roman's winning it, but that's about it. But I think he was just sort of, you know, that's an awful long time ago. And just to think that these guys have been on tour the whole time, thinking he got away with it, that's when he sort of said how angry he was about that stuff. So, yeah, no, if you've not read that, it's an interesting piece from Ollie's perspective of being dragged into that by being involved in two of the fixed matches. So give it a glance if you can.
No, it really is a very good piece from you, Phil, speaking to Ollie Lyons in recent day. Well, Phil, we would like to tell everyone now that we are part, aren't we, of the Sport Social Podcast Network. We were asked if you wanted to join up, and we're very happy to do so. There are some marvellous podcasts on there, so we feel we're in very good company. We're still feeling our way into this new arrangement, I think it's fair to say, but it's very nice to see the podcast up in lights on the Sport Social Network. It does mean you'll now hear a few adverts on the podcast, which is hopefully not too much of an inconvenience. We're not going to get rich anytime soon, Phil, but I think for our standing and our credibility, it does feel like a real boost.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they asked us a while ago, and it sort of, we wanted to kick off the new season with this new arrangement. So, yeah, good to be involved. Loads of good podcasts on there. So have a look what else they've got to offer. And, yeah, another step towards professionalism from us.
Well, we've got quite a lot of steps before that, if we're honest. Big leaps, really. Phil, we're both off on rather big trips, aren't we? Very different affairs. I'm heading to Bulgaria. The first time for ages, it feels like. Well, just going somewhere. I haven't done enough of that lately. So people say, why are you going there, Nick? The answer quite simply is, I'm just going. I'm really looking forward to it. And you, sir, are off to the world's biggest music festival. You're going to Glastonbury. You must be looking forward to it loads.
Yeah, can't wait. Going Thursday morning, I think. Yeah, I've been a couple of times before. It is a unique experience and one that takes quite a few days to get over. So, yeah, I'll be recovering for a while the week after that. But, yeah, no, it's going to be great. Great lineup. I think the weather looks good. So plenty to look forward to.
Good man. And, yeah, you mentioned there, our next episode, actually. We're building in a bit of Glastonbury hangover time for you, aren't we? Let's be clear here. So yeah. We're likely to be with you next Tuesday, which is June the 27th. And we'll be joined on that episode by one of Fleet Street's genuine big hitters, Jeremy Wilson, and The Telegraph, for a special Your Views episode. We'll be addressing all your recent correspondence. Still, we probably close the lines on that on about Wednesday, so a couple of days still to get your views in. So whatever's on your snooker mind, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the new season? Which players can you see doing well in this campaign? Maybe you're looking forward to attending a tournament in the new season. Whatever your snooker views, let us know. Tweet us at Talking Snooker or email talkingsnooker@yahoo.com. Then just to say, a week after that, we'll be joined by Brendan Cooper, the author of a new book, Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. And I'm intending to read that actually when I go to Bulgaria. So looking forward to that. So two lovely voices coming up, Phil, but should maybe finish by reflecting again, unless you've got anything else on your notes there, that we've had a smashing guest in Nui Heathcote. We thoroughly enjoyed it and wish him well for the new season, which is now about to start. It's back. The beautiful game is back.
Yeah, it just feels funny, doesn't it? I think it's just the weather makes it feel funnier. It's so sunny and hot outside that it just feels odd. It might be one of those where they're playing in shorts again. I think it was this tournament last year they were allowed to play in shorts at some time because it was so boiling in there. But yeah, looking forward to it, of course. And yeah, thanks to Louis for being on. And yeah, I guess with Jeremy as well, if you've got any questions about his career, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer that. Really great writer in newspapers and books. So, any questions about Jeremy, for Jeremy, just give us a shout.
Definitely. He's a tremendous journalist. So, yeah, do definitely get your questions in for Jeremy, talkingsnooker@yahoo.com, or tweet us at talkingsnooker, or indeed you can tweet us on our own accounts. Let's go and watch some cricket, Phil. Good. The Ashes, we're delighted to say, is underway. What a contest that will be here in the UK. And thanks for your company this morning here in the UK. And see you next time after Glastonbury. Do have a great time.
Yeah, I'll be doing a Grealish. Don't worry about that. Yeah, enjoy. I'm going to enjoy the cricket now. I hope I enjoy it anyway. I will struggle to enjoy it if England do badly. But yeah, Plenty to look forward to there.
Indeed. And thank you indeed, everyone out there, for your very supportive words after our match fixing episode, for listening to us in such big numbers, and always generally for your company here on Talking Snooker. And we thoroughly enjoyed recording this new episode. We hope you enjoy listening as much as we have indeed enjoyed recording. And for now, from Phil and myself, cheerio.
Sports Social Podcast Network.